Hi everyone, welcome to IDEAS. I'm George Lawson, I'm a member of the Management Committee IDEAS and a lecturer in the IR department. It's a pleasure to introduce on my left Chris Roy-Schmidt. I'll say a bit more about him in a moment, and then on my far left Kirsten Ainley from the IR department here. Chris is Professor of International Politics at the Australian National University, and Fernand Braudel, Senior Fellow for this year at EUI in Florence, very nice gig. And I think the latter is important in terms of trying to situate Chris's work. I don't know how many people are familiar with Fernand Braudel's work, but he's a famous historian of the French Enel School, one of its most influential members. And the Enel School was interested, as I'm sure you know, in investigating the long sweep of history in studies of the emergence of Western civilization or the Mediterranean, whatever it might be. And there's a much misunderstood word that Braudel's associated with, the long durée, which people take to mean just a long time, which is not what he meant. Sometimes they mean the long time, what happened last week, I think. But the long durée is actually supposed to look at the role of very long-term, often ecological, physical changes to the makeup of the natural world. I think Braudel was once asked what he thought the agents of world history was, and he said forests and tributaries. So that was what the long durée was, actually how things changed in terms of the natural world over a long period of time. The second type of temporality for Braudel was the conjunctural time. I'll say a bit more about it because it's how I situate a lot of what I think Chris's work is about and to some extent what the paper tonight is about, which is about thinking in terms of epochs, in terms of periods, in terms of modernity, in terms of changes on that type of scale, the role of human rights, for example, in the formation of the modern world. And then there was avant-mort, events, dust, as Emmanuel Wallerstein often called it, the mere exchanges that we see and we worry about every day to do with Obama or Iraq or Afghanistan or the credit crunch or what it might be, and at the risk of annoying half the population of IDEAS, what traditional history is supposed to be focused on. And to some extent what IR in some of its infancy in terms of its relationship to diplomatic history and political history was also about as well. I think what I've always been interested in terms of Chris's work and where I think I would situate tonight's paper, leading on to the book that's forthcoming fairly shortly, is this interest in the conjunctural, in the second of Braudel's times, away from, if you like, the sort of fetishization of micro-interactions on an everyday basis, and away from also the enormities of plate tectonics and so on. And it's an engagement, I think, a very fruitful one with history and with sociology and other disciplines as well, maybe even with historical sociology, a subject close to my heart, producing extremely rich, historically sensitive work, but also something that has a longer-term theoretical impact as well. And I'm sure you'll know, I think this is evident from Chris's earlier work, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, The Moral Purpose of the State, a book that had a very important, influential impact in generating ideas about the ethical and normative dimensions of international politics and the foundations of the modern international system. Work which I was very interested in, the constitutive architecture and structure of international politics as well, in the modern state system. I think it's fair to say that Chris is one of the most influential thinkers in terms of this wave of constructivist thinking about the social formation of the modern world, and in particular in terms of the ethical and normative dimensions of it. So Chris is here tonight to talk about his forthcoming work on individual rights and the making of the international system. He's going to talk for 30, 40 minutes and really outline that for us. Then Kirsten will discuss for a somewhat shorter period than that, probably 29, knowing her. And then should have plenty of time to have some discussion and some questions. So, Chris, a great welcome to LSE and to IDEAS.
Thank you. Thanks, George. It's a real pleasure to be here. Basically, what I'm doing, I've been doing for about the last year, is sort of taking this argument on the road and trying it out on different audiences to try and find out, as I've been saying, where the landmines are in the project, and there are lots of them. I've just learned to walk fairly cautiously, I've just decided. So what I'm really hopeful is that I'll be able to get some feedback from you about sort of gaps in the project, things that you aren't clear and that I need to clarify in the argument, because that's really what I'm seeking out here. What I'm going to do in this talk is to try to give you a big, really a sense of the entirety of the project. I'm going to talk about, there are three cases in the project that I'm going to talk about, and I want to talk about all three because it's through all three that you really get a sense of the nature of the argument that I'm making. I'm going to do it sort of theory light, focusing more on the history. I'm very happy to talk about the theory in the book, but I think I'm going to sort of put the emphasis on the history and the basic structure of the argument. So I think probably the best way to situate the project is to begin with the conventional way in which IR scholars tend to talk about the relationship between human rights as a form of individual rights and world politics. I think the IR literature tends to have a what I would describe as a kind of shock of the new feel about it. Most of the work on IR tends to focus on the role of human rights in relation to world politics after 1945. If they're particularly broad-minded, it might stretch back a little bit beyond that to the anti-slavery movement with a bit of a nod. But most of the discussion focuses on post-1945 developments and is really a debate about the efficacy of the international human rights regime and its development. So there's a big debate in IR about how did the international human rights regime and the norms associated with it evolve? Are they effective or aren't they effective? And you've got your skeptics on the one hand and you've got those that think that it's had a constitutive impact on world politics on the other hand. Now, it's always struck me, and really the origins of this book come out of this sort of dissatisfaction with this literature, that in fact the relationship between individual rights, and I'll use that term very specifically, individual rights and world politics has a much longer history than that, and the relationship is much more deeply entwined than that conventional account suggests. So really the book is an attempt to argue that individual rights, and more specifically struggles for the recognition of individual rights, have had a profound effect on the development of the international system itself. A profound, deep, constitutive effect on the development of the international system. What I do in the book is take one aspect of the structure of the international system, and I call that, for better or worse, I use the sort of Tonsi name of the structure of political agency of the international system. And by that I basically mean the number of states, their geographical dispersion, regional complexion, etc. in the system. And it seems to me that there is one of the really striking features of international history has been the phenomenon that saw the emergence of a nascent system of sovereign states in Europe in the 16th and 17th century and the gradual globalisation of that system of sovereign states, to the point where we have today, really only in about the last 50 years, in its last phase, the first global system of sovereign states in world history. Now, most, you know, IR scholars tend to talk about the kind of eternal sort of verities of international politics. Well, those eternal verities as a sort of set of global systemic processes are really only relatively recent. So what I'm interested in is this expansion of the system of sovereign states to encompass the globe to the exclusion of other institutional forms of organising political life. Now that expansion occurred in five great waves. The first wave was associated with the Westphalian settlement. The second wave was associated with the independence of Latin America at the beginning of the 19th century. The third phase was associated with the Versailles settlement. The fourth phase was after 1945 with decolonisation up to about 1970. And then the fifth phase occurred with the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Each of these phases was associated with the implosion of empires or imperial, quasi-imperial states. So what we have is a series of great implosions of empires and their fragmentation into sovereign states. To the point where, in the sort of second last act of the story, with post-1945 decolonisation, you see not only the end of the great European empires, but you also see the death of territorial empire as an institutional form at that time. Certainly it's normative death. Now what I argue in the book is that there is a very important constitutive relationship between struggles for individual rights and these great moments of expansion in the international system. And I focus in the book on three of those moments, which I take to be the most important in the globalisation of the system. The first is Westphalia itself. The second is the independence of the Americas. And the third is post-1945 decolonisation. I focus on those because they, together, they bring most of the states that are presently in the international system into the system. And secondly, they give the international system its principal regions. Europe, the Americas, Asia, Africa, the Pacific, come out of those great waves of expansion. And I'm very happy, by the way, in questions to talk about the other two waves and the relevance of the argument if you want, but in the book I place the burden of the argument on those three cases. Now the essence of the argument, and here's where I'll kind of do theory light, the essence of the argument is that these great waves of expansion were the product of what I would call struggles for recognition. Now that in and of itself is not a particularly novel kind of insight in IR. And there's actually quite a large literature that has talked about the politics of recognition between polities and international society, whereby they seek to gain recognition as sovereign actors with all of the rights associated with sovereignty. So that in and of itself is not a particularly novel insight. What I do, however, is argue that I think this is a very unsatisfactory way of conceiving of struggles for recognition in the context of these great waves of expansion in the system. And the reason for that is that I think that the IR literature on the politics of recognition is overly systemic. Right? It tends to be a very sort of third image kind of discussion. So what you've got is you've got a community of extant sovereign states, you've got the elite, political elites of what I sort of flippantly call at one point in the book wannabe states, who then engage in a kind of politics over where, you know, one seeking recognition, the other denying or granting the recognition, and it's all occurring in a kind of international social space. Now, in the cases that I look at, that's part of the story. There is a point in each of these cases where you have polities engaged in struggles for sovereign rights vis-a-vis the extant community of states. But the innovation of the argument is to argue that those struggles for recognition are in fact grounded in deeper struggles for the recognition that are occurring at the level of society. It's beyond, below, whatever you want to call it, the state. And these are struggles for recognition by individuals and collectivities of individuals for the recognition of individual rights. And it is struggles for the recognition of these individual rights in empire that produces crises of legitimacy in empire, the failure, repeated failure of empires to be able to satisfy these demands leads to the sort of transmutation of these struggles for recognition into struggles by polities for sovereign rights. In each of the cases that I talk about, there's a kind of tipping point at which this occurs. Let me say a word about how I use the term individual rights, because I use this very decisively instead of using the term human rights. Some people talk about human rights as being very much a 20th century phenomenon, and they draw a distinction between other kinds of rights claims that occur before that and human rights. I want to see these human rights as being really one kind of expression of the development of individual rights over a long course of history. Now, by individual, I mean A, rights that pertain to or are possessed by or claimed by sole persons. But that's not really sufficient, because there are in fact many kinds of individual rights that you can gain. You can have an individual right as a sole person that pertains to a contract that you have with somebody else. You can have an individual right as by virtue of being a citizen of a particular state. The individual rights I'm interested in are individual in a second sense of the word. They're individual not because they just belong to sole persons, but because they belong to sole persons by virtue of the fact that they are integral moral beings with certain inherent capacities that need protection. Now that idea I take to be at the heart of the idea of human rights. But its origin lies back, I think the critical point is back in the 16th century with the Reformation, with the rise of Protestantism. And I'll talk about that in a moment. Because that's where the idea that you get of individuals that are integral moral beings with certain inherent capacities that deserve protection and respect first emerges. But in that context, there are two things that make those rights not human rights, as we understand them now. First of all, has to do with the scope of the rights themselves. These are negative rights. They're rights, they're appeal entitlements to not be interfered with. Liberty of religious conscience, I'll talk about in a moment. But also, you have in this period a willingness on certain part of certain Christian denominations to claim that they constitute integral moral beings, but deny that status to a whole bunch of other people, Jews, Muslims, various Christian heretical sects. And what happens over time in the story that I look at is a gradual expansion, A, in the scope of the rights, and B, in what Honneth calls the zone of application. That is, the group of people that are considered to be sort of rational, moral beings capable of these capacities that deserve protection. So I think human rights are really part of that expanding story. They're on a continuum, but so they're individual rights, but not all individual rights are human rights. Okay? We'll talk a bit more about that in questions. Okay, so the basic argument is that you have big waves of expansion that are occurring in the international system, collapse of empire, fragmentation into sovereign states. These are about the politics of recognition, but it's not just the politics of recognition of polities in a community of states. These struggles are grounded in deeper struggles by individuals for the recognition and protection of certain individual rights. Okay, so let me talk about the three cases, because I think it's helpful here to put some flesh on this. The three cases, again, are the Westphalian Settlement, the Independence of the Americas between 1808 and 1825, and post-1945 decolonisation. So let me start with Westphalia. For me, the story of Westphalia does not begin in 1618 with the outbreak of the 30 Years' War. It really begins back, right back at the beginning of the 16th century, when Luther sort of provokes the start of the rise of Protestantism and causes the division of Latin Christendom and the conflicts that flow from there on. So in my story about Westphalia, the Westphalian settlement is a settlement to a series of conflicts that have their roots back at the beginning of the 16th century. There are various attempts to resolve those conflicts over that period, repeated attempts, I'll talk about those, that fail. And Westphalia succeeds, I will argue, because of the nature of the settlement itself, which is quite distinctive. What I want to argue is that the crucial aspect, crucial issue that is in contention with the rise of Protestantism is the question of what's called justification, the theological doctrine of justification. The central idea of Protestant theology that Luther enunciated was the principle of what was called sola fide, which was the idea that the individual gains salvation through faith alone. So the individual stands in a direct relationship to God, unmediated by the institutions of the Catholic Church. Because under Catholicism, you gain salvation not only through faith, but also through good works and the correct practice of the sacraments, etc. So this is a radical idea that Luther proposes, which is basically to take the Catholic Church out of the religious relationship between the individual and God. But what is really at the core of this idea is the notion that the individual is a moral being who has a certain innate capacity, the exercise of which gains them salvation. And I take this to be really the kernel of the idea that I think I trace through to the idea of human rights. That it's this idea, the real innovation of Protestantism is this moral individualism. Now, what I try to do in the book, and for those of you that are interested in that chapter, there is a nice section on Hobbes and Grotius, but it comes at the end of the story. Because what I really want to do in these cases is I want to talk about how these ideas worked on the ground to produce political struggle and how these become really central issues in the struggles over that period. There's really three moments in the story that I want to talk about. And the first of those is Charles V's attempts to reunite Latin Christendom in the 1540s, 1541 and 1546, with the Diets of Regensburg. And what Charles V does there is, and for those of you that are interested in attempts to resolve conflict through dialogue, these are fascinating cases, because what Charles V does is this is the Holy Roman Emperor, he brings together the principal Catholic and Protestant theologians and the Catholic and Protestant princes of the empire and sits them down and says, okay guys, let's try and settle this, let's try and reunite Latin Christendom, save the Holy Roman Empire, and come up with a kind of common statement of theological doctrine that we can all live with. And they fail. And they fail principally on the issue of justification. The Catholics and the Protestants just cannot agree on that issue. They come close to an agreement in 1541, but then Luther rejects it and so does the Pope. 1546, they can't even agree on the almost agreed on text that they failed to get up in 1541. It's that failure at the Diets of Regensburg that lead to the next moment, which is the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. And the Peace of Augsburg is I think, really very interesting for what it does as much as for what it does not do. The Peace of Augsburg, as everybody knows, introduces the principle that the prince determines the religion within his realm. And this principle is taken to have been a recognition of the fact of religious pluralism within the empire. But it falls apart very quickly. And the reason it falls apart is because the only individuals who have their right to liberty of religious conscience that are recognised as having that right are the princes of the realm. Individuals who live within those princes' realms do not have the right to liberty of religious conscience. And this just produces conflicts within all sorts of these states. It also produces quite nutty and odd sorts of politics. Because since the prince determined the religion of the realm, you had some principalities of the Holy Roman Empire, like the Palatinate, where over a period of 50 years, every time a dynast changed, there was a change of religion. So you had whole populations. Every 10 years, it was like, okay, we're Catholics today. No, we're Protestants. No, we're Catholics. And it's just, you had this incredible social turmoil. The 30 Years' War is, in a sense, the sort of grand, sort of last act of this unfolding of these conflicts. And this brings me to the sort of third point that I want to emphasise, and that is the Westphalian settlement itself. Now here, my reading of Westphalia is somewhat different from most IR scholars, and that is that I focus on a really very large section of the treaties that are largely ignored, and that's the substantial section in the Treaty of Augsburg, which is affirmed in the Treaty of Munster, on liberty of conscience. This is a very it's a very important section of the treaty, and it's it was really at the heart of the settlement of the religious conflicts. What that section does is that, by the way, Westphalia reaffirms the Augsburg Principle. Okay, but what it does in addition to that is it provides protections for the individual to practice their religion within the territory of a prince who is not does not observe the same religion as them. Probably the best evidence of the degree to which that, the extent to which that went, are the provisions in the treaty to do with what happens when a prince changes religion. Is a prince allowed to force others within the territory to practice the new religion? The answer is absolutely not. They can maintain ministers within their own courts, but they cannot force the population to change their religion. So what I think, what is at the heart of the Westphalian settlement for me is this religious bargain, this dealing with the issue of liberty of conscience, which is the issue that is really at the heart of 120 years of conflict. And so the argument that I'm making here is that the conflicts that lead to Westphalia are generated by a conflict over religious liberty. And the Westphalian settlement, which produces these new sovereign states out of the Holy Roman Empire, not only are the sovereign states themselves based on this religious division, but also, as Stephen Krasner says, their sovereignty is compromised by the principles of the treaty. Okay, so I'll leave that one there. Now I want to talk about the independence of Spanish America. This is actually my favourite case in the book because it's the one that I knew least about before I started writing the book, and it's a fascinating period. So let me talk about this one. I don't know how much of you know about the collapse of the Spanish Empire, but let me begin by framing it by talking a little bit about the Spanish Empire, the state of the Spanish Empire in the 18th century. Okay, and the drama all starts at the beginning of the 19th century. But in the 18th century, the Spanish Empire is really in a very sort of parlous condition. The new Bourbon monarchs that come in after the Wars of Spanish Succession, the new Bourbon monarchs up until about 1760 engage in a process of domestic reforms within peninsula Spain, and then after that they engage in a series of really very draconian reforms within the American provinces of the empire. And these impose really harsh new financial principles. They really they decreolize the bureaucracy, which severely pisses off the. Sorry, I became an Australian there. It's annoyed the Creole elites, and then they expel the Jesuits, of course, who have educated the elites. But what's really interesting is that although civil conflict breaks out in the empire at this period, it is never directed toward independence from the empire. The kind of catch cry of these revolts is long live the king, down with bad government. And so we enter the 19th century with very little constituency within the empire for the fragmentation of empire into sovereign states. That all changes with the French, the Napoleonic usurpation of the Spanish crown in 1808. And historians are in near universal agreement that it is that external shock to the system that is really crucial in blowing the empire apart. But even at that time, it is reformers who are dominant, not radicals, in the Americas. And here I want to go in and talk about a sort of empirical site that I think is very useful for illuminating the crisis that actually happens within the empire. And this is the negotiations for a new constitution for the empire that occur in Cadiz under the general courts from 1810 to 1812. Now, what's really interesting about this these negotiations is, first of all, Napoleon usurps the Spanish crown, puts his brother in as Joseph the First. Spaniards across the empire don't like this. They erupt into insurgency and start fighting the French, and they establish an insurgent general courts in Cadiz. And the purpose of those courts is to negotiate a reformed constitution for the empire that would be put in place once Napoleon is thrown out. Now, the courts are dominated by liberals. Okay? It's dominated by people who believe, who are kind of inspired by the French Revolution but opposed to Napoleon. Spaniards across the empire interpret the French usurpation of the crown through the lens of traditional Spanish theories of sovereignty. Now, traditional Spanish theories of sovereignty, both Suarez and Vitoria, are quite different from French absolutist theories. They're both absolutist in the sense that they believe sovereignty comes from God. But under Spanish theories, sovereignty is given to the people first, and the people then pass that or ordain sovereignty on the monarch. There's never any question that the people should be exercising it themselves, but there's this idea that it is passed, mediated. Spaniards interpret the French usurpation of the crown as being that there is no longer a legitimate monarch, therefore sovereignty has returned to the people. Now, this begs two questions. First of all, who were the people? Were all people in the empire one people, or were they two, three, four, whatever? The second was, how should those people be politically represented in a future empire? Should they be represented through an all-seeing monarch? Should their interests be represented through the courts or traditional estates? Or should they be represented through as individuals? Individuals are the unit that requires political representation. And the liberals in the courts are in agreement that it's individuals. Right? So this is a liberal moment in a respect. They're in agreement that individuals are the people that need political representation. The only problem is they can't agree on who is an individual. So the debate at Cadiz is actually a fascinating debate about who among all the peoples in the Spanish Empire constitute rational adults with the capabilities to exercise the right of political representation if they had it. Americans believe that everybody, except including freed slaves, but not including slaves, was a rational adult. Peninsular Spaniards disagreed. They argued, first of all, that only Creoles, people of Spanish descent, were rational adults. And everybody else, Indians, freed slaves, were to be excluded. They lose out on the Indians bit, but they end up arguing for that Creoles, Indians, and Peninsular Spaniards be represented, but not freed slaves. This is the most heated aspect of the debates at the Court of Cadiz, and the Americans are defeated because they're outnumbered. So the Peninsular Spaniards just outvote them in the end. And basically the Americans leave the courts basically radicalized from that moment. That's the tipping point in the sort of balance between reformism and radicalism in the empire. And it's over this question of whether or not they are going to be granted. Because essentially what happens is that the new constitution treats Americans as second rate in terms of political representation compared to Peninsular Spaniards. So it's this crucial issue that radicalizes Americans and tips them over. It's one of those tipping points from a sort of struggle for the recognition of individual rights into a struggle for sovereign rights. Okay, now I'm only going to say the most basic elements about the third case because I'm looking at the time. The third case is post-1945 decolonisation. I'm going to say relatively little about this because it's the one that I've published on, and some people will know the piece Human Rights and the Social Construction of Sovereignty, which deals with this case. I'll just recap the argument that is there. To cut it short, essentially what I do is piggyback on the argument that Robert Jackson makes about post-1945 decolonisation, which is that whilst the strength or weakness of particular empires may have had a bearing on the fate of the independence of particular colonies, we cannot explain the wholesale dissolution of Europe's empires within the space of 20 years, nor can we explain the end of the institution of empire itself, right? Territorial empire, I mean, I don't want to get dragged into the argument about whether the US is an empire, territorial empire. The death of this, Jackson argues that this can be attributed only to the rise of the right to self-determination and a revolution in ideas about sovereignty. Now, what I've argued is that the problem with Jackson's argument is that I think he provides an adequate description of that. He identifies it, says this is what happens, I think he's right, but he has no explanation for it. How did this new right of self-determination get established as a normative standard? And what I argue is that that process occurs principally within the negotiating fora for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the two international covenants on human rights. The right of self-determination had, of course, been important after the Versailles settlement. But the right of self-determination after Versailles applies to particular European peoples, and secondly, it applied to them by virtue of their status as ethnic groups. So it's a right that is granted to a collectivity, a cultural collectivity. Nazism kind of kills that off, because in one respect, the sort of idea about a greater Germany is a kind of perverse sort of logical development of that kind of idea. So after 1945, the right of self-determination, which is in the Charter, but the content of which is not adequately defined in the Charter, has to be given content. And it has to be given content in a way that it actually will be suitable for the peoples that now want it, which is peoples in the great European empires in Asia and Africa and the Pacific, which were not, as defined by the boundaries of the colonies, generally homogeneous ethnic groups. They were multi-ethnic communities. Now, the real action takes place, in the forums for the negotiation on the international covenants, where first wave post-colonial states, and I use that kind of broadly, I've probably given my own language of waves, I should probably use a different language, but basically what I mean by that is American states that get their independence during the 19th century and find themselves in the UN, and states that have gained their independence immediately after the Second World War, states like India, Pakistan, and so forth, are basically, they play a crucial role in the codification of civil and political rights. Now, I recognise this is a completely revisionist argument from the conventional story about how the West established civil and political rights, and then the Soviet Union favoured social and economic, and then the Third World favoured social and economic and collective one. You know, in fact, I think that standard story we tell is completely wrong. And if you look at the negotiating history, what you find is that a coalition of some Western states and post-colonial states adopts by far the most radical position on civil and political rights. For example, I won't go into it now, but the optional protocol is largely the result of the position taken by those states on the right of individuals to petition human rights bodies. So what I argue is that these states play a crucial role in codifying new human rights norms, and then what they do is they graft the right of self-determination to those norms. So that to sort of cut it short, the kind of revolution in norms that Jackson points to is in fact grounded in a politics about individual rights. So that's the end of the third case. Let me just finish by giving kind of one of the punchlines of the book. The second last chapter is a chapter called The Generative Paradox of Rights and States. And in that I argue that if the story that I'm telling is correct, then the role that individual rights have played in international politics has been a sort of paradoxical one. On the one hand, the politics of individual rights has helped generate the very system of states that we see today. But as that system develops and its pathologies develop, we start to get by the way, let me just preface this. We tend to think about, when we think about rights and institutions, we tend to think about today as human rights and institutions beyond the state. But actually, in most rights struggles through history, it's been the state that actors have been struggling for against empire. The empire has been the sort of the unjust institution, and the state has been the guarantor, potential guarantor. Over time, the kind of limitations of that come to be seen, and you start to get a kind of, as Ruggie calls it, a sort of unbundling up to another level. So you've, at once, rights politics are involved in both the generation of the system and its kind of partial, just beginning, perhaps, transcendence of that system. I don't want to get into teleologies, by the way, but I think that's the dynamic that's gone on. And what we, in our conventional stories that we tell ourselves, we only see the second part of that story. So I think that there's a much deeper set of connections between individual rights and the system than we've generally thought. So I'm going to finish there. You know, I talk too much.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's great. Kirsten.
Thank you. I found the paper I was fortunate enough to read, but I think is the first chapter of the book before the talk, and I found the argument fascinating. And the first question I want to ask is just to clarify, as you presented here, what your aim is in writing the book. And is it just to get our history right? Because the historical argument is a very convincing one. It's great to see an alternative story than the story that we usually tell. Or is there something else behind this as well? Are you looking to strengthen a claim that we have human rights in a time that human rights are increasingly under threat, even in liberal states, to say they have a much longer history, a much deeper foundation than IR, and as such, to add to the argument that they exist, or even to predict in the future, as you just finished with, that they may transform the system yet again? But then you focused on the history in the presentation and said you were only going to do theory light. Well, I wanted to ask you some questions that were theory heavy. there are two points I think there are now three because I've been scribbling furiously through your presentation, but I will take no longer than 29 minutes. but the key points I want to raise the questions on are the differences and tensions between individual rights and human rights, and between individual rights and group rights. So the first, between individual rights and human rights, you acknowledge the difference between them, and you seem to posit individual rights as somehow coming between human rights and more classically conceived citizen or civil rights. Mm-hmm. The more traditional distinction is just between those two. Mm-hmm. Civil rights or citizenship rights, which are based on some kind of idea of a social contract, which are specific, they're enforceable, and they're reciprocal. There are duties attached to each right, and there seem to be much stronger rights than human rights, which in general are seen as deriving from natural law. They're being based on some kind of claim, a universal claim of what it is to be human, rather than a particular account of what it is to be a citizen of a particular state, what you're owed by that state because of your relationship to it in a notional social contract. You don't base individual rights on any kind of idea of citizenship or social contract. You're very explicit that you don't. And your account of individual rights is much closer to a natural law account. Some sort of conception of what it is to be human as an integral moral being. But you recognise that that conception of what it is to be human hasn't been spread to all human beings across all time.
And I'm making, when I talk about that, I make it as an empirical observation rather than as a normative argument.
And then you, at the end of the piece, say that individual rights have effectively become human rights, that since 1945, all human beings, without exception, have been entitled to an array of positive and negative liberties. And I was interested, you discounted positive liberties in your talk, but at the end of the introduction, you do include positive liberties as well.
Right.
So it would seem from your argument that if there ever was a divide between men and citizens, that's melted away, that individual rights have now become human rights. The question I want to ask on this is whether or not this divide is actually still in place and is still critically important. Is the individual rights that are claimed are still to a large extent based on citizenship or social contract rather than on some conception of agency. And I wonder if the commitment to seeing all human beings as fully developed moral and political agents is little more than rhetoric. If we look at the history of the Cold War, at the superpowers during the Cold War being more than willing to tolerate gross abuses of human rights in regimes that were sympathetic to them. And the end of the Cold War hasn't brought the end of human rights abuse. In fact, after 9/11, we've seen an increase in human rights abuse. We don't seem to be making any progress. The majority of states don't protect human rights. So for a system that's based on individual rights, which are now human rights, we see a surprisingly little commitment to human rights. And I wonder whether that's because the rights that we really defend are rights that are still connected in some way to citizenship. Do you see a real gulf in the protection of rights within liberal states and rights within autocratic states, authoritarian states, between states' protection of the rights of their own citizens versus states' protection of the rights of foreigners? So I'm wondering how much purchase citizenship or the social contract idea still has. Why are people and politics who have fought for individual rights, supposedly these rights have now become universal, why are they not fighting for everybody else's rights? Exactly. Why is it they fought for their own and are now happy to enjoy those and to fight very little for others? And the other thing that occurred to me when thinking about the links between rights and citizenship is that the conceptual link between rights and citizenship still seems important when we think about the rights of women. It's still the case that women aren't seen as archetypal citizens. They don't fight in national armies, by and large. They don't contribute equally to the economy. They don't play a substantial role in politics, in many cases, nor act as heads of families. And neither do they have equal rights in many states. So is this connection, which you want to dispense with, actually still more important in the world than we like to admit? Yeah. So does the distinction between men and citizens remain? The second point is about the inherent tension between the group rights to self-determination and individual rights. And you talk a little bit about that in the chapter, and you'll talk about the grafting together of individual rights and group rights. But they're actually still very distinct, and the politics of rights now are still very distinct. So questions over whether peoples, so collectives, have the right to preserve or promote particular ways of life, particular cultural practices, whether that's the practice of Sharia law or some kind of caste system, religious schooling. These are all efforts to exempt groups from upholding universal human rights as we see them. So the idea that they're grafted together seems to me to be problematic. The argument you make that individual rights are to some extent constitutive of the present international system and that they're becoming increasingly important, I would expect to see that would be at the expense of group rights, because group rights protect groups from having to observe individual human rights, if we can take it that individual human rights is now a correct phrase post-1945. And if it's true that the individual rights have helped constitute the present system, shouldn't we expect to see them increasingly superseding group rights, and that the individual rights that help constitute a sovereign state system are helping to constitute, as you kind of allude to at the end, a post-sovereign state system, a truly global system, in which there is no such thing as collective or group rights, because there is one collective of humanity, and all of that humanity, as a group of individuals, has the same human rights. Or if we're not seeing a post-sovereign state system, then at least we might expect to see a system of increasingly liberal states in which any clashes between group rights and individual rights are relatively minor. And the evidence doesn't seem to point that way. We don't seem to be moving towards a more liberal world. And it's questionable whether we're moving towards a more globalised world in a normative sense. Certainly we may be in an economic sense. Rights to sovereignty and self-determination still seem to be defended much more strongly than individual rights within institutions of power in the international community. So I was wondering whether you think the struggles over things like humanitarian intervention and the establishment of the International Criminal Court are the death throes of the sovereign order and a birth of this new order that you seem to allude to at the end of the chapter, or actually the rebirth of the sovereign order and the imposition of group rights over individual rights. And then last point, if I have time for it.
23 minutes or something. Carry on.
Is on this question of group rights and individual rights. I wondered how linked the ideas of moral individualism within Protestantism are to the expressions of a desire for freedom seen within Latin America and the decolonising states after the Second World War. Can we be sure that they were all basically talking about the same thing? I mean, you do talk, and you spoke in the presentation that the rights of the individual were, the discourse that was used to to claim freedom from imperial rule was a discourse of individual rights. But wasn't the concern more really with group rights, effectively, in Latin America and the decolonizing states after the Second World War? There wasn't a discourse about the nature of moral agency, the nature of the individual. There were debates about what groups should be able to do within empires, and if they weren't able to represent themselves, then they should be. And to some extent, particularly after 1945, these fights were to be free from the moral individualism of the West. So if you look at the Asian values debate, the moral individualism of the West is seen as a great problem.
Sure.
So the discourse of individual rights across these examples, while it looks like much of the same language was being used, I don't know whether the same things were being meant, or whether that language, I guess particularly post-45, is seen as having political purchase and is therefore used as turning the weapons of the empire against itself.
Sure.
And so it's used more for that reason than for a deep belief in a particular kind of individual political agency. And of course, this doesn't matter if individual rights and collective rights are all grafted together, if one follows from the other and if they're conceptually linked, which I think you seem to imply. But I want to ask you whether they are, whether group rights and individual rights are conceptually linked in terms of human rights discourse, because in practice they seem to pull in fairly opposite
directions. Yeah.
Absolutely. No.
Fantastic questions. So, and as with all good questions, you kind of reorient yourself. Brain out, you guys. Okay. Now, let me give my best shot at least, if not necessarily dealing adequately with the questions, giving you a sense of how I've seen them in the project, okay, so at least clarifying my sense. Your first question, which is about the aim of the project, you know, is it just to get the history right, or is there kind of some greater ambition in sort of argument about rights and so forth than that? And I think that the argument is both an attempt to get the history right. But I think it's first to get the history right, but then the ambition is greater than that, because I think that getting the history right about the relationship between this development of the system, and I'm very careful that I'm not claiming that individual rights have transformed all aspects of world politics, but I'm saying that they were critically important in this very important strand of development of the system. Okay, I think actually if that argument is correct, then we end up with a more complex argument about the sort of origins, the dynamics underlying the development of the state system itself, the development of sovereignty and individual rights, which I think, you know, people who know this, some of the recent stuff I've written on sort of normative theory and empirical theory, will know that my view is that all normative theories rest on empirical assumptions that sort of taken for granted from which people reason and argue normatively. And I think, you know, I gave this presentation at the EUI with a political philosopher who... Her paper was all about the necessary connection between the sovereign state, in liberal theory, the sovereign state and individual rights. And one of the things that this project does is it undercuts that argument. First of all, because it argues that ideas about individual rights and political struggles actually are generated in a transnational political context. But also that there is this kind of... that it's not a matter of the sovereign state and then you have ideas about rights and rights dish out and the sovereign state then dishes out citizenship rights. It's that there's actually this much greater sense of sort of mutual constitution going on between them. And I think that's sort of for the conclusion, but I think that actually affects the kind of normative arguments that we can develop out. It's a different platform on which to build. And so in that respect... I don't just want to get the history right. I actually want to. I want us to be able to think about how that different set of empirical understandings can give us a different footing for our normative arguments, if that makes sense. Although, actually, I don't spend a lot of time normative theorising in the book, and it might be a little bit of that in the conclusion. On theory, I mean, you had a lot of terrific observations under that second question. Let me boil it down to what I think is the kernel of it, which is, you know, are you saying, Ruth Smith, that the relationship between, that the old tension between men and citizens is dead? Okay? And I'm absolutely not saying that. Okay. I guess the way that I see this is that, and in the book, the theory that's in the book, there's a little bit of it in that intro, is theorizing the, in a sense, the kind of the politics of recognition that is gradually changing over the period from the Reformation, from where prior to the Reformation, you have in Europe a kind of what Honneth calls a traditional recognition order. This is a world in which rights are apportioned socially on the basis of social status and prestige, social status and role. Okay? What happens gradually over time is that you get the emergence of another set of ideas that becomes what I call a sort of modern recognition order, that becomes more and more embedded. It does not affect all institutions, but it becomes a kind of moral language, a set of underlying norms that actually says there are some that legal norms should be apportioned to individuals on the basis of the fact that they are individuals. So they should be apportioned, that there are some rights that everybody should have, all people should have, defined as rational individuals. So there's a gradual transformation that's going on there. What I'm saying is that this transformation, the contradictions within those new norms and the relationship between those norms and the institutional structures of empire produce political struggles that fragment empires, okay, and become the justification for the creation of sovereign states. Now, one of the tragedies of this story is that in almost every case, those individual rights that are appealed to as part of struggle are not translated into citizenship rights. And I mean, the Americas is a classic example of this, that the constitutions that immediately precede, that immediately follow the revolutions, are among the most religious, among the most liberal negotiations, but they then collapse. Okay? And so what happens is that the sovereign state, which is a product of struggles in the name of rights, then becomes a kind of political architecture that is a suboptimal provider of these rights. Okay? So, and then citizenship rights, you know, so what you get built right into these transformations is a disjuncture between the kind of political struggles that generate the collapse of empire and the actual codification of rights internally. And I think that, and so the codification of rights internally becomes part of a domestic political story, where we get over time the development of liberal polities with particular architectures of liberal rights that tend to instantiate particular sort of ideas about the rights of men and citizens. You know, there's a kind of universe, there's an ideal of universalism embedded into the rights of the state, the liberal state, but these are not reflected in all states. And so you end up with a sort of parallel moral language that actors can pick up on to struggle against political institutions. And what I see, what I've done is pick up on a number of these struggles over time that have been transformative on the system. There are all sorts of other struggles that are going on using the same moral language within states internationally by transnational advocacy networks, as Sicking talks about, picking up on the same language to lever political transform in political struggles, a way of levering political change. But it's not the only moral language that is out there. And I think, so I hope that's dealt with the men and citizens part of the argument. Let me now deal with the other thing that I think is bothering you, which is what's the relationship between individual rights and collective rights in this story? Okay. The best way I can explain this is that I neglect collective rights in this story. Because in the cases that I'm looking at, the rights that are really important are individual rights. And you used the example of the Americas. Well, isn't it sort of collectivities that's going on there and ideas of nation and so forth? Actually, that's not the case. I mean, what's really interesting in the case of the Americas, and historians have kind of used the language of saying it is anachronistic to play back the language of nation into the politics that precede the breakdown of the Spanish Empire. Because in the breakdown of the Spanish, what's interesting here is that in the breakdown of the Spanish Empire, there is no agreement as to what should be the political units. There is an agreement that Americans constitute a different people from Peninsula Spaniards. But that's an argument about the origins of the original contract between the Spanish Crown and the Americans, what's interesting is that the Americas are given by the Pope to the Spanish monarchy, not the Spanish state. So for Americans, they believe that they are different from Peninsula Spaniards because they have different constitutional history. But then they can't agree. There's arguments that the political units should be the boundaries of the viceroyalties. There's arguments that they should be fragments of those. There's arguments that about pan-Americanism that Bolivar was big into. But what is the crucial idea in this is that empire has become a fundamental violation of the rights of Americans as individuals. And that's the language that's going on. In the post-1945 case, I think that's also what's going on there. Because in the politics, the international politics of self-determination, it is explicitly not ethnically defined nations. It's peoples understood as bounded by colonial boundaries, but as individual rights holders. It's not a notion of an ethnos that's operating here. And the moral argument that is used in the negotiations of the, for example, the 1960 Declaration on the Rights of Colonial Peoples, is a moral language about individual right, about the primacy of civil and political rights, about the role of the state in preserving civil and political rights, and about self-determination as being a necessary prerequisite for the realisation of those rights. Now, that is different. That is different from post-Versailles. And I'm very clear in the book that I think the case after Versailles, of the five waves, is the outlier. It is the case where it is culturally defined collectivities, group rights, that are really operative. There's two things that make post-Versailles really stand out as different from the other cases. First of all, there's a top-down dimension to it. The great powers have a real role in sitting there saying, you know, Woodrow Wilson's committee sitting in Washington going, right, that's an ethnic group there. Let's put a line around them. You can have right. You're not real. You can be a minority. Okay? So there's actually a kind of top-down dimension that is missing from the other cases. But also, there is a cultural ethnic notion of group that is operating there, and the group is the entity entitled to the right. Individual rights are not part of that story in the same way. So I think that's the place where that really works. But in the other cases, I think it's individual rights that are operating. Now, just let me finish by saying I don't think that I'm not therefore making a teleological argument that it's individual rights. I think what's happening all the time is that in different struggles, different kinds of rights are being invoked. But what interests me in this project is the individual rights struggles, if that makes sense. So.